President Trump has pardoned security guards who worked in Iraq. For Iraqis, it revives a painful moment.
It's a real kick to the stomach for ordinary Iraqis who had hoped that justice could be served.
Also today, tough times in Israel. COVID cases are soaring, the economy is reeling, and nobody's in charge.
Now we are entering another new year without a functional budget.
And just how diverse is the corporate world?
New Zealand is at 45.5% of board seats taken up by women. On the other end of the spectrum, as an example, Saudi Arabia is at 2.6%.
And worldwide, proportions of people of color on corporate boards, even smaller. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Among the pardons that President Trump has made are pardons for four Blackwater contractors who were convicted of brutally murdering 14 Iraqi civilians in 2007. The killings caused outrage in Iraq and around the world and remain a large part of America's legacy there. With us now to discuss reaction in Iraq to the pardons is Ali Al-Molawi. He's a co-founder of the Iraq Policy Program and senior analyst at Inside Iraqi Politics. Ali, welcome. What has been the reaction to the news in Iraq, both politically in Baghdad and also how ordinary Iraqi civilians are taking it in?
Well, there's been total outrage, understandably. A lot of people have spoken out against the pardon, and both within the political blocs, amongst the political elite, and also amongst ordinary Iraqis. There was a statement issued by the foreign ministry just recently expressing regret for the decision. Of course, I don't think anyone really expects the decision to be reversed, but the statement by the foreign ministry kind of expressed hopes that the decision would be reversed.
So how did these killings impact the U.S. presence in Iraq in 2007? Take us back to the moment.
Well, it was a very infamous incident. In fact, as you know, 17 people, innocent people, were murdered in cold blood by these contractors. And there was huge outrage at the time. You know, it happened in a square in the middle of Baghdad called Nasur Square. You know, Blackwater contractors claimed that they had come under fire, but FBI investigations showed that actually all the people that had been killed were carrying any weapons. And so it was a huge outrage, and it called into question a lot of what was going on in Iraq in terms of the presence of private security contractors and also U.S. troops in general.
How will this news impact the relationship between Iraq and the United States at this point, do you think?
Well, as you know, I mean, tensions have been quite high for some time now, particularly because of the assassinations that happened last year in the airport. As you know, senior Iraqi and Iranian officials were killed. And I think, you know, this really will just add to the tensions that, currently exist between Iraq and the United States and also with Iran. As you know, Iran plays an important role in Iraq. And I think people are very worried that, you know, these pardons may just add to the escalation in tensions that currently exist in Iraq.
Do you think these pardons could have any effect on the current U.S. presence there?
These armed groups have been launching mortars and rockets in the direction of the U.S. embassy for some time now. In fact, only a couple of days ago, they launched an attack. And, you know, groups like this try to push this narrative that the United States really just isn't a reliable partner for Iraq.
Ali, have you heard any reaction to these pardons from families of the victims killed by Blackwater contractors in 2007?
Yeah, so some of the families of victims have spoken out, both in local and international media. To be honest, a lot of them have said we're not really surprised by this decision. I think people were very skeptical back in 2007 about receiving justice for their families. And I think this pardon has just really proven that their cynicism was correct.
So how can the U.S. ensure a strong relationship with Iraq in the future under Biden?
Well, I think what the United States needs to do is really just reverse a lot of the policies that Trump has had with regards to Iraq. And, to me, I think that Trump's approach to Iraq has been extremely abusive. And I think what Joe Biden needs to do on January 20th moving forward is to really state that the United States' approach is really going to be very different to the way that Donald Trump has treated Iraq.
Ali, how do you remember this incident in 2007? What was your impression of what happened, and how do you feel today?
You know, I drive past Nusur Square often. When I drive past, I think about the incident because it was just so infamous. You know, it's a real kick to the stomach for ordinary Iraqis who had hoped that perhaps justice could be served, at least in part, through this incident.
Ali Al-Mulawi is a co-founder of the Iraq Policy Program. Ali, thank you very much for speaking with us about these pardons for the Blackwater contractors. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
President Trump issued a total of 15 pardons and 5 commutations on Tuesday. There might be more to come. Inauguration Day is less than a month away, so if we see more pardons, it's likely to spark more controversy. But as the World's Sarah Birnbaum reports, Trump's use of the pardon power is hardly unprecedented.
There have been many times when U.S. presidents have issued pardons that raised eyebrows, but Trump is taking things to the next level.
The power to pardon is a beautiful thing.
Trump is using pardons to reward his friends, to dismantle the legacy of the Mueller investigation, and to send a political message. Can he do that? Actually, the power to pardon is the closest thing to an absolute power that presidents have. We can thank the founders and Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution for that. But usually, this involves a careful process. The Justice Department reviews petitions and makes recommendations. And Trump is having none of that, says Stanford Law professor Bernadette Myler.
Trump instead has done a much more kind of personalized set of grants of pardons and has looked for people who, you know, are celebrities or whom he has connections with or who could make, in particular, a political point if he pardons them.
Myler says Trump's use of the pardon power harkens back to the days of kings and queens.
A lot of Trump's pardons have struck me as being very similar to these pardons that were extremely controversial in the 17th century and that suggested an over-involvement of the king in the justice system.
This goes back even further to medieval times. The British Parliament gave the king the power to pardon in 1535, during the reign of Henry VIII. Andrew Novak from George Mason University says pardons go back even further than that.
The pardon power seems to have existed, or something like it, in most centralized political systems in history. The Roman Empire had it, the Chinese Empire, the kings of Wessex in the 800s, pre-colonial societies in Africa and the Pacific.
Novak says the concept is pretty straightforward. It's about the king or ruler having a chance to show benevolence. And it's really linked to the idea of divine mercy, says Bernadette Myler. A pardon is like a royal act of grace.
We see a kind of analogy between the king and God, right? So God is granting mercy, and the king, as a representative of God, is also granting mercy. So there's a kind of Christian and spiritual connection there as well.
That whole notion makes some Americans uncomfortable, says Novak, in part because democracies are supposed to work differently.
There's no principle of equality with pardons, that when you exercise mercy, you don't necessarily exercise it for everyone in the same position. And that can feel like it's unequal or unfair. I would also say that mercy is about pulling your punches when punishment is truly deserved in some cases. And so it feels like someone deserves punishment, but they're not getting the punishment.
Still, Novak says pardons can do more good than harm, and most systems around the world have some version of it.
We did a big study of all the countries in the world, and we found that the pardon power existed in almost all the world's constitutions.
He says out of 200 constitutions, maybe 10 don't have a pardon power. But many countries put limits on the way it works. For instance,
Malaysia restricts self-pardons, that the elected monarch of Malaysia cannot pardon himself or his close family members. Kenya, which prohibits pardons after a presidential election until the new inauguration takes place. So there's no lame duck pardons in Kenya.
And there's Nigeria. It prohibits pardons for corruption. None of those limits are in place here in the U.S., but that's not to say there are no checks on pardon power for American presidents. Akhil Amar is a constitutional law scholar at Yale.
First, let's remember that the pardon power only applies to federal crimes and not to state crimes. Second, the president himself is subject to the impeachment process.
Of course, that doesn't always work out. That's why, Amar says, there's an overarching safeguard, you and me.
The people can weigh in. If the president's misbehaved, they can toss him out.
Amar says in the past, when presidents have misused their pardon power, they've often paid a political price.
If Donald Trump is promiscuous and corrupt in his use of the pardon power, that's going to come back to haunt him if he wants to run in 4 years.
Last year on the campaign trail, President-elect Joe Biden was asked if he would pardon Donald Trump. Biden's answer was unequivocal that he would not. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
More than 40 women are taking U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement to court. It's a class action suit on behalf of a group of migrant women who were held at a detention center in Georgia. They say they were subjected to medical abuse, non-consensual or unnecessary procedures while they were in custody. Azadeh Shashahani is one of the lawyers representing the women in the case. Azadeh, when these women describe this medical abuse, what exactly are they alleging happened at the detention facility?
We have a pattern of forced gynecological procedures, in some cases leading to sterilization. So women went in for a minor procedure, and then, you know, in some cases, the next thing they know, their fallopian tube is removed, or, you know, there's a hysterectomy, or there's some other type of procedure that nobody explained to them. They didn't know what the purpose of it was. The manner in which they were treated was extremely inhumane. Then they had to live with the damage to their bodies. You know, in some cases, the inability to have children from that point on, the pain that they had that day and for days and sometimes for weeks on end, and just the grave emotional damage that they suffered as a result of this treatment.
So the person the women are alleging did these unwanted procedures is Dr. Mahendra Amin. Did he work at the detention facility, and does he still work there?
He had a contract with the facility, which I should mention is run by a private prison corporation, LaSalle. They are not currently sending women to see him, but I should say that ICE knew as early as 2018, based on the information provided by at least one woman that they were concerned about, you know, this medical abuse that Dr. Amin was inflicting on them. ICE refused to do anything and continued to send women to see this physician.
I mean, part of your class action lawsuit says that the women were retaliated against for speaking out against these alleged abuses. Is deportation one of the ways of retaliation?
Exactly. Deportation is one way. There's a whole array of mechanisms that ICE and the private prison corporation have used in order to try to silence the women. So in the spring, for example, a group of women came together and produced the video because they were afraid about the lack of protection provided to them against COVID. And as soon as the video got out and as soon as journalists started talking to them, the facility, instead of addressing their concerns, retaliated against them by placing them in solitary confinement, which led to really grave emotional damage for them.
How confident are you that either the solitary confinement or the deportations have been an attempt to silence the women?
Very confident. One of the women, Haromi, she was one of the people that we spoke to for our complaint filed in September. And as soon as our complaint started receiving national attention, the officers at the facility started interrogating people about who has been talking to the lawyers. And Haromi came forward and said, yeah, I did. I was one of the ones who spoke. And then the next thing she knew, she was deported the day after. So it's a very clear tactic of retaliation against those who are speaking out.
As to the medical procedures themselves, what has ICE said in response? Do they confirm that these procedures happened? Does ICE acknowledge that some of these women were put in solitary confinement?
There is no meaningful acknowledgement or acceptance of responsibility at all on the part of ICE. I think Congress and the new administration really need to be asking some questions. And at the end of the day, what we're asking for and what we have been asking for several years now is for this facility to be shut down.
Azadeh Shashahani, one of the lawyers representing the women in this lawsuit against ICE. She's with Project South, a nonprofit in Atlanta. Azadeh, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Think back to just over a month ago, who among us didn't have election fatigue, or still does. Thank goodness we only have to do that every 4 years. Think about people in Israel. Voters there are now getting ready for their fourth national election in less than 2 years. The world's Ariel Osaran joins me on the line from Tel Aviv. So a fourth election in 2 years is unprecedented in Israel. I mean, it's not just unprecedented. It feels surreal, like Groundhog Day. What's going on, Ariel? How'd we get here?
That's absolutely right, Marco. Basically, Israel's parliament, the Knesset, dissolved last night. You know, back in April, Netanyahu and his main political rival, former army chief Benny Gantz, agreed to form a unity coalition to avoid a fourth election just like this one. And in Israeli politics, you choose from different parties, and the largest one forms a majority coalition. The deal they made in April included an agreement where Netanyahu had to hand over power to Gantz next year. But first, they needed to decide on a budget, and that did not happen. Hence where we are now with the government dissolving.
So they didn't pass a budget. That means there is no budget. How is the government then dealing with this pandemic?
You would think they could figure this one out, but the last budget Israel approved was back in March of 2018. Since then, political leaders haven't been able or willing to agree on a budget. And like you said, that's been disastrous to the local economy. I asked Yochanan Plesner about this. He's the president of the Israel Democracy Institute. Basically, he thinks Netanyahu wasn't too pleased with the part of the deal where he had to give up power to Gantz.
In order to prevent that from happening, Netanyahu basically held hostage the budget, and we continued for an entire year, and now we are entering another new year without a functional budget.
How angry are Israelis right now? Are they blaming Netanyahu for all of this, if he's been prime minister during the whole crisis?
A majority of Israelis definitely hold him responsible for this fourth election cycle. But I should remind you that Netanyahu is Israel's longest serving prime minister. He's still seen by most Israelis as the best fit to lead the country. I mean, look, even now, his Likud party is polling first. There's a reason why they call him in Israel the magician.
Right, but it's not magic. So how does Netanyahu do it?
Well, Marco, on the one hand, COVID numbers here are soaring. Israel's on track for its third nationwide lockdown, and it's suffering from the worst recession in decades. On the other hand, Israel has secured millions of COVID vaccines. I mean, it's on track to be one of the first countries in the world where everyone gets the vaccine. And we can't forget that in recent months, Israel signed normalization deals with four Arab countries. So it's not that much magic. It's more like Dr. Bibi and Mr. Netanyahu complex. I asked Yochanan Plesner from the Israel Democracy Institute about this, and this is what he had to say.
We're experiencing a low point in terms of political instability, deep recession, and dealing with a pandemic like other parts of the world.
This is really the perfect storm of crises. There's a massive drop in trust in political institutions and also between Israelis themselves.
It'll be interesting to see what happens to Netanyahu. So one final question, Ariel. Netanyahu is actually on trial right now on corruption charges. Where does that stand?
Yeah, that's right, Marco. So in February, Netanyahu's trial is going to enter its evidence stage, and then you're going to see witnesses testifying in court. But the trial itself is expected to drag on much longer than that, way past election date, which is set for March 23rd. You know, Netanyahu believes that his best chances to stay out of prison as if he remains prime minister.
More big news to come from Israel in the new year. The world's Ariel Osaran in Tel Aviv. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Wall Street is having its moment of introspection. The Nasdaq wants companies listed on its stock exchange to be more diverse. They're urging them to add women, LGBTQ, and people of color to their corporate boards, or face the consequences, delisting from the exchange. If you look globally, though, just how diverse are corporate boards of directors? Cynthia Soledad has the numbers. She works for the global executive search firm Egon Zehnder, which authored what's called the 2020 Global Board Diversity Tracker. Cynthia, get us going here. Aside from trying to more accurately reflect society's concerns, why is diversity on a company's board so important?
What we know to be true is in any decision-making process, there is benefit to bringing diverse perspectives together. And if we think about the power and the impact of the decisions that corporate boards make, it's absolutely critical that those boards reflect diverse perspectives.
So the 2020 Global Board Diversity Tracker, the report, it looked at businesses in 44 countries. What countries have the most diverse corporate boardrooms and which countries score worst?
The numbers that we'll talk about right now are focused on the balance between male and female representation on boards. But one of the things we were excited to do this year as well is expand that conversation. And yet the data that we have regular access to is very focused on gender diversity and gender representation on boards. So some of our leaders at a country level, New Zealand is at 45.5% of board seats taken up by women. On the other end of the spectrum, as an example, Saudi Arabia is at 2.6%. So that gives you a sense of the range of representation that we are seeing across the world.
So is it because of the countries where those companies are located, or is it mostly about initiatives taken by the companies themselves?
It's a combination of things. In some countries where there has been incredible progress, there has actually been a regulatory conversation around this, i.e. requirements and quotas that have been set at a country level for representation. And in other countries where it maybe hasn't reached the point of quotas, there is an observation at neighboring countries where quotas have been put in place that actually has influenced behaviors at a company level, even if a country government is not getting involved in the conversation.
So you've touched on a couple of factors for why companies have not made more progress toward diversity at the highest levels. If you had to cite the top three, what would you say are the factors that have stunted the process?
One is staying within known networks. Many times board director seats are filled by people who are introduced by people who are already sitting on the board. So I think that is number one. Number two is this criteria for who will be considered as ready for that seat. There is often a criteria, understandably, that they're most interested or demand that somebody is already sitting on a board. So reconsidering that criteria is important. And then the third is, from a process perspective, the importance of demanding a diverse slate of candidates be considered for roles and noting when there is underrepresentation of an identity group that would be valuable for the sake of the business conversation.
Is this the first time that we have kind of real hard data on LGBTQ representation on corporate boards?
Yes, collecting data on LGBTQ representation on corporate boards is very new. Unfortunately, it is still not possible globally because there are many countries, many jurisdictions where it would be unsafe to report one's LGBTQ identity. But where we can collect data, that data collection is starting, and just having that transparency and that awareness makes a big difference.
Cynthia Soledad works for the global executive search firm Egon Zehnder. She was telling us about the 2020 Global Board Diversity Tracker. Cynthia, good to have you with us and explaining this. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. In the far north of Canada, everyday items are really expensive, so people who live there just order from Amazon, which means long lines at the post office.
I was expecting to spend at least an hour and a half in line, so the fact that it took less than that has got me in a really, really great mood.
Buried in mail in Canada's Arctic, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. This was a scene in the UK today at the port of Dover. Truck drivers scuffling with police at the port. Perhaps 5,000 truckers are stuck there waiting to go to France. A travel ban imposed by France made that impossible. Mainland Europe has been trying to keep people away from Britain after a new strain of the coronavirus is discovered in the UK. So truckers have been stranded at the British port for 3 days now, waiting to enter the Channel and make the 31-mile underwater drive to France. Last night, France lifted the travel ban with a catch. Entrance into mainland Europe will require a negative COVID test result. But truck drivers say no one is telling them how to do that.
Police? Police from 3 days told us that testing will be start soon, but they don't know when. We just won't make the test and just go straight to home.
This afternoon, British Army troops arrived to help healthcare workers administer tests. Still, the government says it will be days before the backlog is cleared and all drivers are free to travel. In the meantime, there are the bathrooms to deal with, not enough of them. Rod McKenzie is with Road Haulage Association and spoke with the BBC.
We can imagine that with that number of lorry drivers, around about maybe 4,000 trucks, toilet facilities, washing facilities, wherever they are, will be pretty overstretched and frankly inadequate.
There have been some bright moments for the stranded drivers. Last night, hundreds of hot meals were delivered to the makeshift truck park set up near Dover. Dinners were provided by the Sikh charity Khalsa Aid. Its chief executive, Ravi Singh, says it was the least they could do.
To see if we can reach out, provide a hot meal, to lift the spirits of these guys. At least we can give it a bit of human warmth and love.
On the other side of the channel in France, in the seaport city of Calais, tensions are rising for another reason. For years, Calais has been a gateway for migrants heading to the UK. It's just a 40-minute ferry ride across the English Channel. Recently, complaints have been growing in Calais about police violence against undocumented migrants, arbitrary arrests, and illegal evictions. Reporter Rebecca Rossman followed along with one group trying to document the alleged abuse.
It's 8 a.m. outside the police headquarters in Calais, and Isabella Anderson is waiting in her car. She's with a group called the Human Rights Observers, and she's watching for the moment when the policemans in front of her pull out of the station.
We've come here to meet the convoy and follow them to the day's evictions.
Evictions that have become an almost daily occurrence, with the police evacuating migrants who have been coming to Calais, setting up makeshift shelters. For years, the French authorities have been trying to discourage migrants from coming here. So police vans are now heading straight into the camps and seizing belongings. Anderson trails them.
They've gone that way.
We follow the police to the camp, a few dozen small tents set up in a big, grassy, muddy field. There are about 30 people here. Most are migrants from Eritrea. It's one of several camps Anderson will be visiting today. In all, there's about 1,000 migrants living in conditions like this in Calais. When we reach the camp, Anderson jumps out of the car and whips out her phone to start filming. An officer quickly approaches us.
Écoutez, madame, vous n'arrêtez pas de nous suivre. Vous êtes sur un terrain normalement interdit.
She warns Anderson that she's on private property and asks for her ID. After that, the officer continues carrying out the evacuation, seizing things like backpacks, tents, and bikes from the migrants.
You need to bring it with you, otherwise they're going to take it.
The story of migrants in Calais is long and complicated. At the height of the 2015 migrant crisis, there were more than 6,000 people here. Most have left, but Calais is still a way station for migrants.
Are you trying to go to the UK or you want to stay here?
UK.
This Eritrean man is trying to get to the UK. He preferred not to give his name because he's undocumented. More than 8,000 migrants have successfully crossed the English Channel this year by boat. When I ask a group of men why they don't want to stay in France, they all come up with the same answer.
They have Dublin like this, they don't give him paper.
The Dublin Regulation, which states asylum seekers who arrive to the European Union must apply in the first country that they reach. People here say their applications have already been rejected in France and other countries. The UK is their last hope. Isabella Anderson with Human Rights Observers wishes France would be more welcoming.
Why should people live like that? Why should it be like it's better than nothing? Why can't it just be like good, dignified, humane conditions for people?
Anderson and other migrant rights groups also say the French authorities can be far more aggressive than what we witnessed today.
On a daily basis, they're being hit. They're being tear gassed. They're being chased by dogs. That's not accommodating.
I reached out to the French government to talk about this, but my interview request was denied. Maya Conforti is a volunteer with the Calais-based nonprofit L'Auberge des Migrants. They help migrants with the basics, getting food and tents.
One of the big problems also is accommodation. In the UK, it's not like that. In the UK, you arrive, you can ask for asylum, you put in a hotel for 2-3 days, and after 2-3 days, you're given, you know, a small apartment, you know, nothing luxurious, but you're not staying outside.
In a deal reached with the UK last month, France agreed to provide migrants with better housing to disincentivize them from crossing the English Channel. But the details of that are unclear. For her part, Anderson says she's seen zero steps taken from the French government to better accommodate migrants.
You saw today, it's just every 48 hours, they're being harassed and exhausted and chased down by police.
Until that's addressed, she says, migrants are going to keep trying to cross the channel into the UK. And she understands why. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Calais, France.
The number of journalists detained around the globe hit a record high in 2020, nearly 1,300 journalists behind bars worldwide. That's according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, the CPJ. For the second year in a row, China tops the list with the most journalists in jail. Joining me now is our Shanghai correspondent, Rebecca Canther. Rebecca, you've spoken with a number of Chinese journalists about their experiences. What is the situation on the ground for them? What do they face as they're carrying out their jobs, reporting the news?
Well, the CPJ puts out this list of how many journalists are in jail every year in December. This year, China has 74 journalists in jail. And since the time of the count, actually another two journalists have been put behind bars. So I spoke with Stephen Butler at the CPJ. He's monitoring the situation in China. And he said that journalists who are working for official state media, I mean, they're supposed to express their loyalty to the Communist Party. And so that keeps them from reporting freely.
So there's really very little possibility of journalists in those sanctioned publications to report against the official narrative. Now, you do see sometimes windows. And this happened, I think, in January and February when there was a bit more off-script reporting by the official media. But it didn't take very long for the government to clamp down on that and force everybody to toe the line.
So January, February, that would have been around the time of the coronavirus outbreak in Wuhan. Is it possible to generalize about many of the journalists in jail in China and what they are accused of?
A lot of the journalists on the list are actually citizen journalists. They are doing independent reporting on labor disputes, human rights violations, everything that's going on in Xinjiang, even what was going on earlier this year as the coronavirus outbreak was happening in Wuhan. When they're reporting on these kinds of topics, that's very embarrassing to the Chinese government. It goes against the state narrative. And so the government gives them warnings, and if they continue, they're arrested and charged and put into jail. And some of them are accused of endangering national security. Some are accused of picking quarrels and provoking trouble. That sounds like a minimal charge, but it can lead to 5 years in prison.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, even powerful media moguls like Jimmy Lai of Hong Kong's Apple Daily newspaper, they're not immune to the Chinese government's control. I mean, Hong Kong has been a place for decades where journalists could still report more freely. But this year, with the passing of the national security law, there's been a drastic change. And, you know, he was arrested for national security charges.
Jimmy Lai. So I imagine, Rebecca, most Chinese journalists know what real journalism is. I mean, they also need to earn a living wage. So they must be under enormous pressure and stress.
They are under a lot of pressure. They are doing their job at risk of getting into trouble with the law. I talked with Chinese colleagues who are working with foreign media. And one person I talked to wasn't able to use her name, but she used to be a news assistant with the Washington Post. And she told me about her experience.
We were invited by the security police for tea. The invitation and also the tea is a kind of warning for you, like, you know, the big brother is watching.
A tea invitation from the security police, a warning, she said, like big brother is watching.
Yeah, and that's extremely common. I've heard that from several Chinese journalists working with foreign media. And they told me on reporting trips, they would be followed by local police and be detained. And the people they interview are pressured not to talk with them. And, you know, Chinese journalists who are working in foreign media, they can't even be classified as journalists because the Chinese government does not allow Chinese people to officially work as journalists for foreign media. So they're called assistants, which is a big understatement for the amount of work that they're doing. One of the recent arrests in China was a veteran Chinese journalist currently working with Bloomberg, Hayes Fan. She was picked up December 11th and has been accused of endangering national security.
So these 74, now 76 journalists in prison in China, what are the typical conditions of their imprisonment?
Well, for many, it's unclear what their actual conditions are. Some have not been formally charged yet. But we know about one journalist, Zhang Jian. She's a lawyer turned citizen journalist. She was one of the several citizen journalists who were arrested for posting videos on social media of what she saw in Wuhan right at the height of the coronavirus outbreak. Stephen Butler says she's depressed, she's on a hunger strike, and she's being force-fed through a tube. He says that the government sometimes improves the conditions for journalists who confess, you know, confess to some wrongdoing.
But when you have people who are stubborn saying, look, all I was doing was carrying out my, you know, constitutional right for freedom of speech and freedom of the press, and I was reporting accurately, they don't like that.
So her trial is set for next week, and we'll hear more about that, I assume.
Getting to the bottom of the coronavirus at its source, precisely the kind of thing journalists ought to be helping us understand. The World's Rebecca Canther speaking with us from Shanghai. Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thank you.
You tune into the world to hear interviews and stories that connect you to the rest of the globe. The conversation about those stories continues on social media 24/7. Be a part of the discussion and connect with our team of journalists. You can follow us on Twitter. We are at The World. Amazon is everywhere, not literally, but pretty close to it. In fact, the company just opened a new pickup depot in one of the most remote cities in Canada, a place called Iqaluit. Interestingly, the new warehouse comes after nearly a decade of complaints about Canada's postal service in the region. As Emily Schwing reports, Iqaluit has been buried in packages for years.
Post offices across North America are managing their busiest holiday season yet, as the pandemic forces even more gift givers to buy online. But in Iqaluit, delivering mail is even more complicated. The city sits on a treeless island 1,300 miles north of Ottawa. It's actually closer to Greenland than to Canada's capital city.
So I've placed all of my orders since like October for Christmas. So all of those orders are like slowly starting to come in now.
Inder Panesar has lived in Iqaluit since 2013. She stops into the main post office almost daily.
Looks like I've got some parcels and a card.
Now she has to make a second stop to get the rest of her mail. She drives 5 minutes through town to an overflow warehouse where her packages are waiting for pickup.
I'm actually quite surprised. The last post office we went to, the line wasn't that long. I was expecting to spend at least an hour and a half in line. So the fact that it took less than that, like way considerably less than that, has got me in a really, really great mood.
After she parks, she heads for the door. Outside, big orange wooden barricades are set up to direct people into line. Sometimes temperatures are well below zero while people stand out here. Today, though, there's no wait at all.
I don't know what kind of luck I have today, but I'm going straight in. I'm doing it. Let's see what happens.
For years, people in Iqaluit have complained about long lines at the post office and 2 to 3 week delivery delays. It started to get bad in 2010 when Canada ended its food mail program. The program used to subsidize the cost of shipping food and essentials to far-flung communities like Iqaluit. At about the same time, Amazon extended its prime benefits to the mostly Inuit residents of Canada's farthest north capital. Soon, Iqaluit's main post office was inundated with Amazon boxes. They were filled with diapers, canned soup, rice, flour, and even furniture. Things like this cost a fortune if you can even find them in a local store.
For one thing, a major problem in there is there's so many people in general delivery.
Exan Moffat-Tays is a rural postmaster and also represents Nunavut and other parts of rural Canada for the Canadian Postmasters and Assistants Association. She says there's simply not enough post office boxes for everyone in Iqaluit, and that sorting all the deliveries takes a long time. Adding to the problem, high employee turnover.
The average time a person stays in there is never, definitely not a year. For us, right now, if someone were to start today in the Iqaluit post office, their first starting wage would be $17.38 an hour, which is completely low, right?
In 2017, Canada Post built the extra warehouse to handle the increasing number of incoming packages, but it didn't help much. The onslaught of mail got even more intense when the COVID-19 pandemic hit last spring. Mayor Kenny Bell says at this point, the city simply won't order things like personal protective equipment and medical supplies through Canada Post.
We know that it's not going to get here in any kind of time, so we would send it through cargo mail instead. It's extra cost, but it comes faster.
Mayor Bell doesn't even go to the post office anymore. Instead, he pays someone to pick up his mail for him.
Awesome. Thank you.
Meanwhile, back at the warehouse, it only takes Inder Panesar about 20 minutes to get her packages this time around. They're Christmas presents for her family. She says she's looking forward to making use of that new Amazon Depot, which she hopes will take pressure off the post office and speed up delivery times.
That's going to be really, really useful. I'm hoping to use that service really soon as well. Apparently wait times are only 2 to 3 days for Amazon items, so that'll be interesting.
But those packages are going to an old airplane hangar out by the airport, all the way across town. For The World, I'm Emily Schwing.
Tomorrow on the show, a Christmas Eve theme, an hour devoted to stories about music and food, like the obsessive ritual of British Christmas pudding. Not familiar with it?
If you picture like a kind of half a bowling ball made of dried fruit, brandy, breadcrumbs, basically as much alcohol, sugar, and carbs as you can, and fat as you can ram onto a plate, and then boiled and steamed dark black, and it's dense as well. You know, you can definitely stick a fork into a Christmas pudding and it will support its weight.
Yummy. And then comes the coma. And on Christmas Day, our favorite stories of the year, Mexican-American breakdancers, the hottest, slimiest cosmetic craze in Asia, and tried and trusted Norwegian tips to get you through the long winter during a pandemic, turning our upside-down smiles right side up. The world's gift to you on Christmas Day. For most Christians, this will not be a normal Christmas. Normal is putting it mildly. For many around the world, the end of 2020 marks the end of a year of concurrent disasters, devastating floods, unprecedented fires, destructive hurricanes and cyclones. Many faith leaders around the world are now making the case that climate justice is the moral cause of our times. That's what we're taking on today in our weekly look at climate change solutions, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Brother Benedict Ayodi is a Franciscan monk in Nairobi, Kenya. Brother Ayodi is also a member of the Global Catholic Climate Movement and joins me from Nairobi. Brother Ayodi, thanks for being with us. Kenya has had a really tough year. What climate change impacts have you seen firsthand in Kenya and other East African countries over the past 12 months?
The climate impacts that we've had indeed in this year, we've experienced a change in terms of rainfall patterns. We had the worst floods early this year, and not only in Kenya, but also in Rwanda, Somalia, Burundi, Ethiopia, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, and also in Tanzania and Mozambique. 700,000 people affected in all these countries. We've also seen intense droughts, so we are expecting hunger and famine in some parts of the country, and indeed of the continent. We've had scarcity of water because of the drought. So we've seen that there are conflicts in several parts of Africa. So this is causing conflicts.
Brother Ayodi, what has been the human cost of all these disasters you've been describing in East Africa? And how have you, as a climate activist, addressed that human cost?
Of course, the people who suffer most due to the effects of climate change are the poor. And we have, big population living in extreme poverty. And so we have a training called the Laudato Si Animators Program that we train people on how to tackle this issue and how to take climate action. We have programs like divestment programs. This divestment is calling Catholic and non-Catholic institutions to divest from fossil fuels.
As a Franciscan monk, Brother Ayodi, you take your spiritual cues from St. Francis when it comes to faith and being a good steward of the environment. So explain the connection to St. Francis and why do you do the work that you do?
Oh, that's a very, very good question, and I'm glad you asked it. St. Francis was motivated by faith to care for creation. He started seeing everything through the eyes of nature and the humans in what we'll call the cosmic fraternity, that each and every creature, we are interconnected under one God. Everything he personifies, he gives human names to creatures in the sense that they all have their dignity and integrity in them, and therefore they need to be cared for and not be destroyed. It is a spirituality, it is a way of life. It is a way of connecting with God by caring for the environment.
Well, there are plenty of opportunities to relate to nature in the wild in Kenya. I gather you are experienced at escaping from lions, Brother Ayodi.
I'm delighted. I probably read the story I wrote a couple of weeks ago. We were in one of our houses in the coastal part of Kenya called Peketoni. On this particular day, we went to go and milk our goats and cows. But when we came out of the house, we realized something strange. It was a lion that had attacked our cattle. It was actually eating one of the goats there. And suddenly we faced the lion right in front of us. When we tried to turn back and run, one of my colleagues, you know, just fell on the ground and he could not run anymore. But it was a scary moment. So we called the police. And what the police did was they wanted to shoot the lion. But one of the missionaries, who is a Franciscan, pleaded with them saying, why can't we just let the lion go back to its natural habitat?
So what happened?
They left it to feed with the goat. Later, it walked back to the forest. Each and every creature has its own dignity and integrity, and therefore it needs to be respected and cared for.
So, Brother Ayodi, Christmas is just around the corner. It's a holiday for many. This year, the chance to be in community, though, is being discouraged. Where do you see themes of sustainability and human connection to nature in the story and traditions of Christmas, in Kenya especially?
Traditionally, here in Kenya, people have different ways of celebrating Christmas. Instead of people going out to buy a lot of stuff for Christmas and celebrate, we are encouraging people instead to participate in charity. We are promoting people instead of doing a lot of celebration and eating, they will plant trees. They come together and plant trees, especially in dry areas. Some other, you know, people are distributing seeds for planting when the rain season comes. So this is just the idea of reducing this consumeristic behavior. And this also a way of celebrating as a community.
Well, you have a happy Christmas, Brother Benedict, and thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas to you and all who will be listening.
Brother Benedict Ayodi is a member of the Global Catholic Climate Movement, speaking with me from Nairobi. At the end of our conversation, I asked Brother Ayodi about singing, a song perhaps that he turns to, a Christmas song that sets up the connection between his faith and nature. So he gathered a couple of his singing colleagues in Nairobi and came back to the microphone a few minutes later.
Hello, Anna. I hope you got the songs. The first song is called Njoni Wapenzi, which...
Brother Ayodi sent this note to our producer, Anna Kusmer, explaining what the song is about. It's an invitation for Christians to come praise the newborn baby Jesus on Christmas.
So we should bring gifts, you know, from our farms, from the environment, and from anything we have to welcome the newborn baby Jesus.
Connecting environmental gifts with the holiday. So from Nairobi, here's Brother Benedict Ayodi and colleagues with their song in Swahili for the season.
Tufanye shangwe, timbe haleluya, Mokozi Bwana amezaliwa. Malaikani tutangazia, Mokozi Bwana amezaliwa. Furaha yetu ni kubwa sana, Mokozi Bwana.
Lovely work, everyone. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Be strong, stay safe. We'll see you back here tomorrow.